And Ron Larkin, Reel 2.
Sustainability of the helicopters, and of course, the force as a whole is sustainability. How long we could sustain the force? We were now 4,000, shortly going to be 8,000 miles from home. How long could we keep the whole show on the road? These were important high-level considerations which all of us were worrying about with our different contributions to it. We found various bays where we could literally turn round, for instance, vehicles in certain circumstances. One wanted to sort of dump craft ashore in a bay or dump vehicles ashore in a bay from a landing craft while you performed some other juggling feat and then reloaded them and moved them around again. Lots of movement round the anchorage by various rigid inflatable boats and that sort of thing run by the Royal Marines. Myself and the Commodore spent a great deal of time visiting ships, getting to know the masters, the captains, having meetings on board fearless, generally building up the whole way we were going to conduct the maritime amphibious end of the amphibious force, a great deal of it being based on personal contact, personal trust. All these relationships were being built up. Ships by the day arrived from the UK, ships taken up from trade with the conversions that I mentioned, or with their own loads, perhaps needing readjustment. A number of parameters were building up. I'll just go over to the military preparations. We had to do all kinds of things, of course, in terms of keeping the military formations who were with us in good shape. It's a particular problem when you embark infantry on board ships. How are they going to remain prepared, battle-ready, and fit? We had five formations arriving in bits and pieces, all of battalion size. There was 40 Commando, 42 Commando, and 45 Commando with Royal Marines, and two and three para from the paratroop regiment. They embarked in various ships, mainly of the railroad variety. Again, records will tell you which they were, but a large number of them, I think three formations, were embarked in HMS Canberra, in the P&O ship, SS Canberra. And whenever I visited her, she was absolutely, literally, sort of almost, you could feel her vibrating with the soldiery pounding around the decks, keeping themselves fit. But you have to get them ashore as well. They have to do various exercises of weapons. And the whole business of zeroizing weapons is an important element shortly before you set off for actual action best done ashore. And all this was exercising very much the mind of the military, all part and parcel of our whole, the whole of the logistic picture of how we organize our lives from day to day. Intense activity every day in the anchorage. The macro considerations, again well recorded, but it's perhaps worth indicating how they appeared from our point of view. We had to get a sufficient force together. It was absolutely essential to have a backup to Fearless, which meant Intrepid. Intrepid had been recommissioned, as I've mentioned. She went through a very brisk workup with a large portion of the Royal Ships Company and arrived at Ascension Island literally the day before we left, and that was the final piece of the jigsaw, really, to get the amphibious force into a coherent form. So far as what we're going to do is concerned, there is a whole succession of aims developed as to whether we were going to land on the Falklands Islands with a view to repossessing the islands or whether we were going to land to repossess the islands, which were just an example of two quite different things. Again, the archives will show precisely how this argument or this debate progressed and developed. But as always, one is writing one's appreciation, deciding what to do based on a simple, clear statement of one's objective, and very small changes of the objective on the face of it can mean very major changes in what, in practice, you've got to do. The diplomatic picture was unfolding. We were repossessing South Georgia. The maritime business was proceeding around the Falklands, where Admiral Woodward had arrived with his task force with a view to establishing area control as best he could, the surface, subsurface, and above water. There were the events concerning the Belgrano, the early attacks on the 4th, the Belgrano, the Sheffield, the raid on Pebble Island, all of which are well recorded and illustrated progressive escalations of the pace of events while the diplomatic efforts slowly but surely ran out of steam. Well, after dissension, we went through, obviously, a metamorphosis of attitudes, and it became clearer and clearer as the days passed that we were really in for something pretty serious. I can only really speak for morale in my own ship, but it was very interesting to see how it unfolded. We'd commissioned some 6 months before. We'd been through the process of workup, getting ourselves fully operational. We conducted a deployment to the West Indies in a training capacity, that is, taking training officers on a six-week deployment. We'd done one exercise in Norway, which really got us our full colours so far as being qualified, not just worked up, but really qualified and into the swing of things from a amphibious point of view. We'd done a lot of thinking about how to station ships relative to prominent land features, which was very important as things turned out, and I'll return to that. I found it fascinating getting the ship going. It was my fourth command of an actual ship, and I'd also commanded a squadron of nuclear-powered submarines before. And the whole business of how you get people to enjoy what they're doing and feel committed to it was very much our business. We had a slightly sticky start in that getting a ship out of a civilian dockyard is a fairly sort of mind-grinding experience. We had all sorts of tremendously difficult milestones to overcome, but we had achieved our dates. We'd had a good shaking down period in the West Indies. One thing I particularly recall was we visited Curaçao and Aruba, two Netherlands islands in the Netherlands Antilles, and there we had Admiral Fieldhouse as our guest for 3 days. He likes to visit ships as the commander chief from time to time. We had a band concert, which is one of those things which sailors very much enjoy. We carried a Royal Marine band with our large vehicle decks with plenty of room to pack in all the ship's company and have a tremendously rousing evening. And everyone got really very carried away, and we had two or three renderings of Hearts of Oak and the Land of Hope and Glory and things. And I remember Admiral Fieldhouse turning to me, and we'd served together before, and saying, "My word, Jeremy, you know, if we could go to war tomorrow, it'd be quite something, wouldn't it?" And of course, this was some month before the whole thing got underway. So here we were, some 6 weeks or so following this event in Ascension Island. And again, I had the same band on board because it was with us in the fleet, and had them on board to give a band concert, which we had not in the vehicle decks, which were absolutely packed with equipment, but we could make room on the forecastle where we got everyone in. It was a very muted evening, and I remember sitting listening to all this, and really the bandmaster could barely get my sailors and people to sing. And certainly it was nothing like the last event. And it wasn't that they were downhearted or there was any depression. Absolutely nothing of the kind. I realised afterwards when I thought about it, they were simply very thoughtful. It was far from jingoistic, which pleased me. They were engaged upon this business in a very sober and thorough way. And yes, it was nice to have a band concert, but they weren't about to lift the roof over it. And they didn't think they were going a way to save the empire. They were engaged on serious business, which they'd been trained. And I remember it gave me pause for thought at the time, but I'm sure I was right about that analysis, and indeed, subsequently, they did superlatively well in just the right way. And this was very much a process of working up for it. We eventually left Ascension with the head of the amphibious force, and I remember Max Hastings remarking in his book that he felt, and he was with us at the time, that it really was a kind of a watershed. Somehow he felt that on leaving Ascension, so something had been set in motion which couldn't readily be reversed. And indeed, as soon as we left Ascension, which is just 5 degrees south of the equator, the weather got chillier. We were watched leaving by a Russian bear aircraft, which attended us within a few hours of sailing, en route from Cuba to Lien to Luanda, where they had a base at the time, I recall, all the other way around. one of our submarine events, I think, as we were leaving, that they were becoming fairly regular. We were getting quite good at them. And generally, we were getting the whole thing onto a very sensible war footing in a very measured sort of way. We gave quite a lot of attention to the track in which, again, I think was one of my contributions, because as a submariner, belonged equally in most parts of the Navy by now, including a bit of aviation, I think I had quite a lot to say about how to route the force in a way that would be deceptive and would be difficult to track. And we were extremely careful about the electronic signature that we put out. We rarely used radar. I think we'd stopped using radar almost from when we used from when we left the UK, but certainly from leaving Ascension Island, we used it, if at all, only with the greatest discretion. We'd been very careful about radio transmissions and emissions before leaving Ascension, because we didn't want to advertise apart from anything else. Anything very much changed when we left. But we got very used by that time to stumbling around in the darkness without falling over other ships. It's quite extraordinary what can be achieved without any radar at all, perfectly safely. And I remember actually the sort of pleasures, really, of standing on the on the wing of the bridge in the darkness with absolutely no lights and no sound, but the sounds of the ship, just the propulsion and the ventilation and the wind, very exhilarating in a way. But that's the way we continued really throughout the period. We were advancing our battle plans. Communications, as always, were a difficulty. We had some fairly elemental entirely encrypted voice communications with Northwood and with other parts of the force, on which the Commodore and the Brigadier were frequently engaged a number of times a day. And of course, streams of written communications of every sort. I remember by this time I was regularly having to read in the order of 1,500 signals a day. Whenever I had a spare moment, I seemed to be turning over signals. First of all, I got extraordinarily good ones. Mine is always adjust to these things, and one's ability to absorb information, decide what was relevant, put aside what was not, became extremely practiced. So the press had become part of our lives. We gave our first rather stilted press conference in Ascension, which the Commodore and the Brigadier chaired between them. The press had been kept very much in the dark, that's a story of its own, mainly in Hermes and in Canberra, which is unfortunate because the captain of Hermes, Lynn Middleton, the senior officer, the naval officer in Canberra, Captain Tony Byrne, known as Beagle Byrne, didn't have much time for the press. I think it's fair to say he didn't make him very welcome. But sometime during his passage south, the press were moved to be with the formations, and when they finally arrived in Fearless, we, for some reason, made them very welcome. And anyway, we were allowed to tell them roughly what was going on by that time. So it was important for us. They were thoroughly disaffected when they arrived with us, and were absolutely overjoyed with the welcome and hospitality they received. And without quite knowing what we were about at the time, it made us some firm friends, and they've remained firm friends ever since. So our experience with the press was by no means an unhappy one. We eventually, again, I must be rough about dates, but it must have been the 19th or 20th of May that we arrived in the battle zone to the east of the Falklands, where Admiral Woodward was conducting his affairs, just near enough the Falklands to do what he had to do to retain the control he knew he was capable of retaining, and at the same time keeping himself clear of as much as he could of the threat from the Argentines, which had to be very nicely calculated, and he did it with his customary precision. We spent one day, really, all together. It's a day very much that I always remember, like one remembers particular days in my life. We became associated with the various secure communications, voice communications going around the force. I talked as the Chief of Staff to the Commodore, to various to two captains I knew very well, Peter Woodhead and Andy Buchanan, who were acting as operational chiefs of staff to Admiral Woodward. We were clearly going to proceed with the landings as quickly as possible. The the other thing I need to describe, I think, at this stage is what we regard as the window of opportunity. Because the window of opportunity really opened when all the window began to roll, as it were. That's not an excessive metaphor. When we left Ascension with Intrepid, Intrepid had to join. So we left Ascension. It was then the question of when we could rendezvous with the battle group, and then the question of when we could cut the landings, and somewhere at the far end of the window was when we felt that we could really not sustain the force 8,000 miles from home. Now, quite how long that would be was a fairly uncertain question. We were getting the feel, I think, that ships and aircraft could be operated, were so well maintained that they could be operated well beyond their theoretical limits quite reasonably. But I think we generally had a feeling that we had about a 2-week window, 3-week window in which to complete our affairs, certainly to get very well established ashore and to be well forward with the base of our own, well forward towards our objectives. Now, we had to do two things before we conducted the landing. It was clearly unwise to send Canberra forward with 3 of our 5 land fighting units embarked. Of course, this was would have been a folly of vulnerability. So it was necessary to extract 2 of the 3 formations in Canberra and place them in other ships. The other thing was to find suitable weather, which meant bad weather, in which to approach the islands in circumstances which would not make it excessively vulnerable to air attack. Unfortunately, the Argentine Air Force, which we knew we had reason to respect, it wasn't all that effective in poor weather. Well, the fate was really on our side, because the day we arrived with the task group, which I think was early in the morning, the weather was remarkably good, and here we were in the open South Atlantic with conditions, and it really was remarkable, where we could afford to dock down fearless and intrepid in open ocean. This is an evolution one normally conducts only in enclosed, in sheltered and calm waters. We use the 4 each of our total of 8 large landing craft to actually disembark 2 formations. 40 commando came to fearless, and I forget which one went to intrepid, but extracted 2 formations from Canberra, leaving one on board, and embarking with fearless and intrepid. And we did that during the course of the day, which was really astonishing, good fortune to be able to do it. The difference was marginal, but quite acceptable, quite acceptable. A lot of helicopter activity. The people took tired, and indeed we lost quite a number of helicopters that day, or one helicopter, certainly, if not 2, through accidents. And one, it may be recalled, was loaded with a large number of people from 22 SAS, with quite excessive loss of life. These splendid men, very tragic. So by darkness, we had the force really established in as near as we reckon we were going to get in the perfect battle configuration. I may say that cross-decking and rearranging the load in landing ships is something that can be a perpetual activity. I'm never satisfied, but we got as near as seemed sensible. So what we needed now was poor weather, and sure enough, the next day it came. We had very bad visibility, and yet not excessive down pleasant sea conditions, and this was just the day to make our final approach to the landings. One thing I won't go into particularly, I think, is the choice of the landing sites. Of course, this is pretty well recorded, although again it needs to be crawled over by inexpert historical hands. But from various candidate landing sites, we decided, or it was decided from various sources of composite advice, ultimately decided, I think, in the War Cabinet, that we would land in San Carlos. Very suitable. Undoubtedly the ideal situation, and yet curiously not one of the Argentines thought of thinking through backwards. I think they were very much of a more myopic variety. They assumed that if we were going to retake Port Stanley, we'd have to land somewhere near it. So they just hadn't got their eyes, were not extended to the sort of reach that we had in mind. So they didn't think of San Carlos. And when we went to San Carlos, they were totally surprised. We added to that surprise by the way we conducted the approach. And again, I take some personal, I had some sort of personal input here. We directed the force, so it looked, if they happened to be following it, as if it was, generally speaking, in a zigzag track, proceeding in the general direction of Port Stanley. And then quite late in the day before the landing, which must have been the 20th of May, we veered off to the north, all in very poor visibility. And again, following the zigzag track, we fainted well to the north, and then during the night, we descended, came down to the north to our real landing area, which meant entering through Falkland Sound, the entrance to Falkland Sound, and down into St. Carlos. There was various Argentine air activity during the day. We'd met the day before, incidentally, and collected all the escort. We knew which escorts Admiral Woodward was going to assign to us. Invincible was going to come some of the way with us to help provide immediate Sea Harrier support. We put the ships in a tight formation, the landing ships, the merchant ships in a tight formation, and disposed the various escorts we had around them, bearing in mind the sort of weapon systems they had available, sea dart missiles for medium-range air defence, and Seagull for close air defence, and of course the various guns and older missiles we had on the various ships. We recognised that we probably were going to be using every sort of weapon system we had. We knew we were in for inshore warfare and air defence, which was not something which any of the ships were designed. So we were all about scrapping any kind of vaguely automatic anti-aircraft gun we could think of around the upper deck of ships, and that sort of thing was well advanced. So far as Phyllis was concerned, incidentally, I had arranged for lots of sandbags to be acquired and filled at Ascension Island in various sensitive bits of the ship, which I knew to be lightly defended, and with a great concern for the added top weight of the ship, in consultation with my engineers and that sort of thing. We arranged sandbags around, for instance, the bridge, and around the top of the operations rooms, which were rather high up in the ship and had no armour protection whatsoever, against light arms fire, really. Back to the approach. The ships were absolutely packed, whereas we'd had 1,400 on board now. We 1,400 on board previously. We'd embarked another 300 plus of fighting infantry formation, 40 commando, and there really was absolutely nowhere to do anything except just move people around for the basic comforts, making sure they could get to get to the washing and sanitary facilities, make sure there was food, and keep people generally cheerful. And of course people were keen to be reassuring each other. All sorts of briefings and order sessions were going on as we made our way towards the anchorage. The plan was to send a number of frigates through into Falkland Sound first and destroyers. Admiral Woodward, of course, had a few days before, as he describes in his book, he'd sent one of his frigates, I think, with alacrity through, with the main purpose of determining whether there were any mines in the Falkland Sound, which was a concern to us. Fearless led the long line of ships in, and again, I advised, and it was decided that we would go as close as we possibly could to the land of West Falkland, and not down the middle of the channel. I was sure that if there were mines, they'd be in the middle of the channel. Whereas right here at the side, I knew we could go very close navigationally, and I rather enjoyed that sort of thing. So we absolutely hiked the headlands to the west side of the channel. Fearless first, Intrepid following, and various and all the various other ships behind. I won't go into who was there because that's well recorded in various books. We came to anchor in Falkland Sound outside San Carlos Bay to do the first landings. We were a little late, and there was a slight muddle navigationally, which I was upset about, which meant that we were slightly legging it to make the actual time of the entrance. Time is the essence of these things. And of course it took slightly longer than we planned to get the various ships docked down, the landing craft to the various ships from which they had to unload troops, or from which they had to load troops from the Canberra, the Norland, which was a railroad ferry, Intrepid and Fearless and various others. And the whole of the unloading plan, immensely complex, in which we're taught you do things, the guns, the this, that, and the other. The bombardment was carried out by Intrim against Argentine positions known to be on Fanning Head, which was to the east of the entrance to Falkland Sound at the north. And there was going to be an action put in hand by the special boat section to locate the Argentine positions and neutralise, and that all went on during the early hours of the morning while the landings were progressing. did the first phase of landing with landing craft going into San Carlos Bay from outside, and then shortly before dawn, or around about dawn, we moved the whole of the assembled shipping into San Carlos Sound and San Carlos Water. We thought quite carefully about how to do this and how to dispose ships, and the way we set about it was really how to use the land features, which were not enormous but were significant. For one reason we chose the San Carlos, drawing on our experience in Norway, where we knew that for fast jets, actually, if you put ships, if you place ships sensibly in relation to land features, it's quite difficult for the aircraft to turn the corners and get their weapons to bear. We knew quite well what we were up against in Mirage and Skyhawk. Sort of fighter ground attack and fighter attack aircraft of various sorts. We knew that with the weapons they had, they needed to preserve, to do their bombing runs, they needed about 5 or 7 seconds on an absolutely straight course. And of course, an aircraft travels at slightly subsonic speed a long way in that time, so they need a good straight run. And to do it on the curve, going around the land feature, is not effective for them. So we made life as difficult as we could. We made some mistakes. We didn't anticipate correctly their fly paths in all cases initially, and again, I was broadly responsible for placing ships in the anchorage. We made some mistakes, I made some mistakes where I recommended the positions, and we had to rethink them as the early days went by when ships were clearly attacked or sustained hits where they could, if placed more carefully, obtain cover from land features. And the first day was quite a day. Once we got into Falkland Sound and anchored with the military ships, of course, the hard ships, trying to provide some kind of protective shield around the merchant shipping, the logistic ships, we thought that we'd be attacked quite soon. The Argentines were surprised to find us there at all. How they did so is quite well recorded in various histories. But by the middle of the day, they were beginning to get some attacks organized from the mainland. I will always remember the first attacks as being scenes of great confusion. I quickly determined that to fight the ship from the operations room, as that was, of course, open ocean style, first of all, it's a small and old operations room. Secondly, it was absolutely packed with the Commodore and his staff. And thirdly, the radars were not very good looking through land features, so I quite rapidly determined the best place to me was on the gun direction level. And I really conducted my aspect of the campaign from there. My job being, when attacks were going on, to fight the ship, doing my best to be chief of staff on the sidelines. But I was concerned mainly with the bigger decisions, the disposal ships and the anchorage, and the broader issues of what we were going to do when we had opportunity to move from San Carlos. All kinds of things had to be done, which I'll get on to later. The great confusion during the first attack. I think I spent the first one down below in the wings of the operations room, as it were, in the corners, not enjoying myself. It was only a small attack, and by the next one I was up in the gun direction platform. Quite a sensible place to be. I had a gun director, an officer, there were two of them who were there